this fear of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? The answer is, yes, you can see. For example, if we are working in office, we can see there are many people, who do their personal things at work. For example, checking the messages, texting friends, wasting time on Instagram, or the other things. So we can see these actions being performed at the place of work where he was supposed to work. But if this person has the fear of Allah and he knows that if my boss is not watching me, if my colleagues are not watching me, but Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has a complete surveillance upon me, therefore he will not waste his time spending for his personal things. If he is getting paid for a specific amount of time in order to do such a work or such a job, then he will spend his whole time working and for the sake of happiness of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of fear of Allah. And we said that at work, when someone is working, he must control his personal desires and having the fear of Allah. And he must know that Allah is watching him. Therefore, when he fears from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, he will not commit something which angers Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. At work, if I'm getting paid and I'm going to strive for a halal sustenance, halal rizq, it means that the amount of money which I get paid for specific hours, in those hours, I should 100% pay attention towards my work for which I'm getting paid, and not for my personal actions or personal desires, personal deeds. Also, for those who are studying in the school or college, the students, they must study in a way that they are not wasting their time in performing other things. For example, when it is the time to study, they must be present at the school. When the teacher is basically teaching, they must be attentive. When there is a homework, they must do it, because this is what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants them. At the age when they're going to the school or college or uni, this is the time, this is the age where they must learn something. And this is an obligation on them. Learning is an obligation. Why? Because they have paid, their parents have paid fees for that, or even they themselves has paid. And the teacher is spending his time, he's giving his time in order to teach them. Therefore, their duty is to study. So if they have the fear of Allah, they will not waste their time. They will put all their potential, all their attentions towards the studies and not wasting the time. And therefore we see such people who have fear of Allah and they study well, they have reached to the high ranks. They've got high status and they are enjoying this life and hereafter, inshallah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
What about you? IRIB English Radio.
To our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The Uni Party's policy abroad is to crush progressive countries, reduce them to chaos, and force upon them a slavish dependency towards an elite United States. Americans should learn that their politicians, either Democrat or Republican, extend the same policy to their own lower and middle classes. Crush any progressive political ideas out of them, reduce them to chaos, and create unwanted dependency towards the U.S. elite. We now present you an article written by Ramin Mazahiri, the chief correspondent in Paris for Press TV. Ramin Mazahiri has lived in Paris, France since 2009. The piece is titled, U.S. Elections Show Letdown in Biden Global, Not Just Domestic, 1 Year After. Speaking with Iranian immigrants to the United States, I always hear a couple of refrains repeatedly. One, why Democrats do not criticize their own politicians when they do the exact things they criticize Republicans for. And two, when Republicans get into office, at least they actually do things they say they want to do. Democrats never do. If an immigrant can pick up on this, why can't the American voters? An answer which is empathetic to the American voter was discussed in the very first column I wrote from the America for Press TV just after the 2020 U.S. presidential election, back when the results were still allowed to be openly disputed. So just 3 days after the election, results are in. Duopoly wins. Trumpism wasn't a cult of personality. He added, the biggest problem is something we tried to address in our coverage of the election from the start, the refusal of the world's oldest and strongest duopoly to allow third-party alternative voices to be heard, much less have some political or cultural power. Americans cannot pick up on these two ideas, which new arrivals can. And because they lack these two political insights, they foolishly expected Democrats to do something seriously different in 2021. Many are surprised at how far to the right Joe Biden and the Democratic Party have behaved since January of 2021, because conservatism, fiscal, political, and foreign policy is the only policy allowed in what is truly a uniparty system, which is a direct result of the forced duopoly. Indeed, politically active Americans would rather rabidly shout at non-believers, that the other side is on the side of the Satan, rather than to honestly discuss the obvious pattern of overwhelming similarities in the actions of Republicans and Democrats. Political reporting is far more interesting in France, where at least there's a multi-party system and proportional, not first-past-the-post, winner-take-all voting. To avoid discussions of such realities, the US media is paid to whip up the basest emotions over the most moral of public concerns and to treat elections like horse races for gambling. There is ruthless suppression of any sustained discussion of ideas which threaten the Uniparty. The US government's seizure of PressTV.com domain last June during the Biden administration, not Donald Trump's, please note, stands as proof of both this sentiment and the fact of duopoly. We can't say that Americans aren't somewhat aware. A slim majority of America does prefer to classify themselves apart as independent. But they are powerless to stop the endless conservatism and reaction of the duopoly and uniparty. It has been said for over a century, because all working and middle-class people simply want morality in economic matters and fair justice in political matters, that the masses of the United States are far to the left of their workers. I've read the same thing from just as long ago about the French. The problem is clearly endemic in their political system, which is Western liberal democracy, which remains a fundamentally aristocratic, elitist, anti-revolutionary, inequality-perpetuating system. Who can be surprised that Democrats haven't reduced inequality, much less tried? The US Democrats, who claim to be progressives, are sending disgruntled messages via text or on Facebook. They must either be new in the United States, naive, hypocritical, or simply playing a role for others. But just as Donald Trump was a net positive because he revealed to even the most thick-headed or simply jingoistic people the glaring faults of Western liberal democracy, so too will the subsequent disappointment of the Democrats show many the light regarding the implacable reaction of the duopoly. Almost as if Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi wanted to fail. Why did she wait so long to even bring to a vote an infrastructure package, which would have provided the campaign of Democrats with something tangible to show for 1 year of Bidenism? Much was made of the fact that campaigning Democrats were begging for this. Negotiations took too long. Could Coral her own party? Or is it entirely possible that she wanted to ensure that there was no progressive component, something which the duopoly has always opposed? I refer to the laughable ideas, to those like myself who are surely quite cynical, to the committed US Democrat, that the United States 1% were going to pay for universal community college, paid vacations in France since 1936, and a host of other entirely sensible and moral ideas which have been quantifiably improving other nations around the world for decades already. The idea is that Nancy Pelosi wanted to delay and then to fail in order to have the minuscule progressive faction known as the Squad to blame, in order to, from this point forward, say that these progressive promises which Joe Biden made are simply not feasible from a political point of view. As it turns out, that the people actually don't want these things per the losing votes. Of course, the duopoly, run by the 1%, wants progressives to fail. They have wanted this decade after decade. They've wanted it so very long The U.S. is now one of just 7 countries, most of the others are islands, without one day of maternity leave. Why did Democrats spend the last year pushing major educational reforms such as sex education classes for children? The false idea that the U.S. was actually founded in 1619 when the first African slaves arrived, and other nonsense, rather than do one-tenth of what they campaigned on. The same answer makes the most sense. Democrats wanted to lose because their real policy is American duopoly ultra-conservatism. My post-election column stressed how, whatever one thinks of Donald Trump or Trumpism, the uniparty American system burned down whatever was necessary in order to get Trump out, precisely because he threatened the duopoly. Indeed, the only thing the U.S. 1% wants, as much as progressives to fail, is to have gotten Trump out. Donald Trump, after all, changed his party affiliation 5 times, and was rejected by the Republican establishment as late as May of 2016. He's not a Republican, but Republicanism has, as the column also predicted, profited from him. This will allow the Republican elite and establishment to eventually dilute and soften Trumpism, rather than giving America a true new start and somewhat revolutionary clean break. This is how effective the duopoly is when confronted with any grassroots movement. And this is also what has just happened. The victorious governor of Virginia was described by the New York Times as fleece-wearing, dad-like Trump in khakis. Republicans were always going to profit from the undeniable success of Trumpism. Republicans were always going to profit from the guaranteed U-turn of a Democratic Party, which held both the White House and the Congress. The duopoly was always going to continue cooperating among each other to enact law after law to make the rise of a third party harder and harder. The duopoly was always going to suppress media and force their media to inflame the moral sensibilities of many over nonsensical and needless issues. The subhuman policies of the United States towards Iranians were easy to try and pin on the seemingly subhuman Donald Trump, but it's a fact which requires no special political insight to note that they were the same policies of Barack Obama, Bill Clinton, and Jimmy Carter. Those Democrats' policies were the same as Ronald Reagan, Bush the Elder, and Bush the Younger. It's a uniparty system masquerading as fair and balanced duopoly. The uniparty's policy abroad is to crush progressive countries, reduce them to chaos, and force upon them a slavish dependency towards an elite United States. Americans should learn that their politicians, either Democrat or Republican, extend the same policy to their own lower and middle classes. Crush any progressive political ideas out of them, reduce them to chaos, and create unwanted dependency towards the U.S. elite.
Start.
Movement.
Speak.
Live in hope.
Toward the pit.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is the one and only stop for you if you have thoughts on your mind and if you're a youth. That's right, it's the youth station. Choo choo ka choo, it's the youth station for you. I'm your humble host, Muzaffar Haider. And here in the studio today, we have with us Brother Mahdi
Najafi.
Najafi, yeah.
Assalamu alaikum, everyone. Welcome to another program. And we're here again today to talk about anything that comes to our mind, and that something must be that affects our daily lives.
Yeah,
Or how we see the world, right? Mm-hmm.
You know, you have really bad people around you sometimes. Sometimes.
Yeah.
You have a person or people who just make you feel miserable. And so you have the choice to either stay with those people or just ditch them and move on.
Mm-hmm. Like a shoe.
Like a shoe. So you feel like you can discard them, certain things you can't. And we said that how some people just keep on wafting back into your life and you can't escape anybody. What if the relationship is marriage?
Or parents, or children.
What if after... I mean, your parents, you can't get rid of them, your brother and sister. You have to do similar,
children,
right?
That's what I'm saying, yeah.
But the marriage, what if you marry someone and you recognize that they're actually not the person that you thought they were?
Look, marriage is something completely different.
No, it's a relationship. Allah brought somebody into your life.
But like,
right?
So, some people tend to think that they wouldn't wait for the right person, their Prince Charming or Princess, what, Sleepy Cinderella, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Sleeping Beauty. It's not Cinderella. Sleepy or Cinderella. Okay. Yeah.
You know, it's not like that. For example, there's a pious woman, she's like, oh, I need a man like Amir al-Mu'mineen, alayhi salatu wasalam. Wake up, you know? The thing is, we are not going to get the perfect soulmate right then and there. We have to grow together.
Mm,
we have to learn how to deal with our differences, right? That said and done, you realize that your wife has got... So you do all that there was, right? And you try to grow together and you realize it's not working at all, right? It is the most disliked thing that is allowed in Islam. Is divorce.
Yeah.
It is allowed, but it's the most disliked allowed act in Islam.
Wow.
Right?
Right.
When is that? Yeah? When is that? It's not when you realize, look, Islam says if you can live in the Quran, it says if you can live in harmony, right?
Mm.
Live so. And if you can't, leave in harmony.
Mm-hmm.
You understand?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Well, why was the generation before us, or apparently so at least, so much better at maintaining relationships?
Who?
The generation before us, and their generation before them as well, even better.
Mm-hmm.
Why were they so much better at maintaining relationships? Or is this just an imagination that I have?
Do you not think it's because of the tolerance levels?
The patience?
Patience and tolerance. They've gone down these days.
Why has it gone down?
I have no idea. Could be. We can think about that. Go on.
If you look at the generations before us, you can see this kind of simple, almost love and affection for others and those in their lives, their distant relatives almost. They will still have this affinity with them and others as well in their lives. And then you see that almost in their relationship with their spouses, where they have a more stable relationship. Whereas today you see divorce rates are so high. I mean, does this all really come down to patience, tolerance levels, and our understanding of people in our lives? And then this idea that if I don't like it, I'll just change it. Whereas those people tried to work and repair relationships.
Mm. Yeah, well, that comes back to Sula Rahim, doesn't it? Look,
Imam Ali alayhi salam, he would repair his sandals, you know? And then if you go... This generation, if something goes wrong with my shoe, I will literally just throw it in the bin and buy a new one. It is so easy to do. I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but that's just generally how society has become. This food has gone a little bit moldy. Let me just chuck it and get... But the generations before, whatever they had, they would mend it. They would take care of it. They would, you know, the whole stitch in time saves nine stuff that your mother-in-law is always going on about, right? We don't have that anymore. Is that why?
Why were they like that, and why aren't we like that? That's a real question, isn't it? Why was that generation like that, and why isn't this generation like them? Why is it different now? You know, although it's easier now to mend things, it's easier now to stay connected with people.
All right, I'm going to ask you to just hold that thought. We're going to come right back after a break.
is IRIB English Radio. You are listening to Youth Station.
Look, when Islam says that stay connected
to maintain relations with family members?
Saying salam, as less as saying salam is a part of it, right? Why? It teaches us to not necessarily stay with the only people that we see fit to be around, right? I might not be a very smart or I might not have appropriate choices when it comes to people, right? But if I do get into a habit of staying connected to the people that are close to me, right? No matter how I feel about that, it's going to soften me entirely. Like, it's going to soften my heart. It's going to soften my character. It's going to make me more tolerable to everything that's around you, because I'm going to learn to live with differences, right? Rather than just cutting off, that's different, doesn't go with my style, doesn't go with my vibe. I'm going to just go not stay connected to those people. No. In your family, that's the beauty of a family at large. I'm not talking about just parents and children. I'm talking about the other, like, uncles and cousins and everything. The beauty of it is there is a variety of people over there. Within one family, there's such a large variety that if you do follow the statement of Islam that you have to be connected with these people, you have to have good relations with these people, you are going to learn to cope with differences with other societies in the larger world, and naturally to the people closer to you, your family, your wives, your husbands, your children, you know. But it all comes down to someone who really is bad for you, right? And you're stuck now. You're stuck in a marriage, for example. Well, I'm just going to phrase it like that. And you realize that this person, there's no way coming back. There's no way back. This person is what this person is, and he's really not good for you, like in all senses.
The
right?
opposite.
He's not really good for you. Like, that's it. Be in the world or the hereafter. You know, that's it. What do you do at that point then?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose we do need to discuss the other side of it as well, because sometimes you do find yourself trapped into a relationship, in a relationship which is genuinely harmful for you. It could be physically harmful, it could be mentally, psychologically harmful, and it can be spiritually harmful. And spiritually is the most important one. But all three of these are important. You know, there are people who are trapped into abusive relationships. Like, literally, they have scars on them, they have bruises on them. And it's not always domestic violence against women. But nowadays, it's even against men.
We
immediately find that funny. But no, this is really happening. The abusiveness of human race has become more. It's almost like Iblis is doing a lab experiment on the human race, just like as if we're rats, and we're failing miserably. So yeah, there's those kinds of relationships. Then there's mental trauma and stress, where a person will find themselves completely isolated. And what the bad spouse has done is taken away all of their friends, isolated them from their family. They have nobody to talk to. And so what happens is they become entirely dependent on the husband or on the wife. And the one who's being abused doesn't even realize that this is happening. This is the worst part of it. And that's where a person sees their spouse as their gateway to Allah. They see their spouse as they ought to be, which is, you know, the completion of their deen, or one half of their deen, or two-thirds of their deen. You know, they see that person as the one who will perfect them. And when that relationship is not taking them towards their perfection, it's devastating. And so they start to disbelieve in Allah, they start to disbelieve in the Quran and the Prophets and the Ahlul Bayt, and they see themselves as distanced from spirituality completely, and it destroys them. All right, so all I've done is highlighted some of the really bad relationships and the signs of a bad relationship.
How do you get out of that?
You need to get out of it, right? Especially if there is no way to change that shaitan of a person that you have ended up with. But the first part of it is to recognize that
this is a possibility. Not everybody finds their soulmate in reality. Not everybody finds a suitable partner.
Can we head for a break? So I can.
Oh, you need a break?
Yeah, I need a break.
All right. Yeah, no, that's fine. We'll come back after a break then. Look at the wife of Fir'aun.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking right now. Yeah.
So,
but like, she'd never say but she didn't have a choice, did she? She had to live with him because he was Fir'aun.
He was,
you know,
he was Fir'aun.
Yeah, she can run away. She or not anything. Well, if it's husband-wife relationship and they're both Muslims, it's a bit easier for the husband, and for the wife, it's a bit complicated, you know.
And then there's the wife of Lut.
Yeah, no, I'm talking about getting away with from those people. Like,
you can't. I mean, even the wife of Lut, he never divorced her. Mm-hmm. He waited for the adab of Allah to come, and then she got killed, right?
Yeah.
But there's no escaping from the spouse in certain situations. And so in those situations, a person, I mean, it's too less if I just say that you have to be patient. It's horrible. We don't have time to go into details of what to do with this, but let me just leave it with this, that look, whether you find a physical escape from such a spouse, like you divorce and you get out of that relationship, or you endure and you stay in the relationship, whichever one of these two you choose, recognize that that spouse that you have been given, although they are a shaitan, they might be evil, they might be really, really damaging to you, it is through that person that Allah is going to grow you.
MashaAllah.
Right? So, Asiya alayhi salam, she was one of the five ladies of light.
Yeah.
Right? How did she become one of the five ladies of light?
Through Fir'aun.
You know, the Quran says, لا يكلف الله نفسا إلا وسعها. Allah never burdens a soul except to the extent of their own capacity, right? So it's very important for us to recognize where
in our tough times, you need to realize that Allah has found me worthy
of this struggle that I'm going through.
Yeah, yeah.
That's all we have time for today. We bid you assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I am what I am because you made. I have what I have. My love is strong because you are the one I call creator. My Alpha and Omega, my protector and my maker. Because of you, in weakness I am braver. My defender and my savior, my giver and my taker. Abiding in silence with patience and guidance. Aware when I need you, the light when I seek you, justice, forgiveness, the strength in my weakness, and my love is strong.
The limelight.
The defeat in Afghanistan offers a chance to rethink America's war machine, but Congress is on the verge of raising military spending to $740 billion. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Peter Moss, journalist. This article is published under the heading, After Afghanistan Disaster, the Pentagon is on track to get even more money. Stay tuned for the first part of this article, please. Afghanistan was supposed to be the good war after 9/11, the one with a legitimate purpose and a happy ending. That also didn't turn out to be true. But while the war's momentum favored the Taliban for years, its final act had the suddenness of a guillotine with a lot more pain. At Kabul's airport, desperate Afghans clung to the sides of the departing U.S. cargo plane. Panicked families tried to get onto the diminishing number of evacuation flights, and 13 U.S. troops helping keep the airport open were killed in a suicide bombing. Just before midnight on August 30, the last U.S. aircraft and the last U.S. soldier got out of Kabul. This defeat could have been an opportunity to rethink the logic of America's war machine. That's what defeats often do. They force you to reconsider the destructive tendencies that got you into the hole. One of those tendencies has been a nearly ceaseless rise in military spending that has little popular support. Even before the fall of Kabul, opinion polls consistently showed that only a minority of Americans think that the U.S. should spend more on its defense. Just 26% in a survey conducted by Gallup in February. And on the day that the U.S. got out of Afghanistan, Representative Barbara Lee, the lone member of Congress to vote against the invasion in 2001, called the Republicans as well as Democrats to finally reconfigure the nation's spending priorities. Now is the time to shift our investments away from endless wars and toward addressing human needs, she said. To understand the next step, you need to go back to April when President Joe Biden proposed a $715 billion Pentagon budget for 2022, which represented a 1.6% increase from 2021. Progressives like Lee were not pleased and were even less pleased in late July when the Senate Armed Services Committee added $25 billion to Biden's proposal. This plus up, as it's called, raised the budget to $740 billion, a 5% increase over the previous year. At that rate, military spending over the next decade would easily exceed $7 trillion, or four times more than the $1.75 trillion Build Back Better program that Biden is trying to push through Congress. That was the legislative prelude to Lee's call for new priorities. 2 days later, on September 2nd, the House Armed Services Committee met to consider the military budget and, as expected, an amendment was introduced by the ranking Republican to match the Senate increase. This set off a debate in which one of the strongest backers of the plus-up was a Democrat representative, Ellen Luria, a former Navy officer whose Virginia district includes the naval station in Norfolk. In one word, we can sum up the why, and that China, Luria said. We are ending our longest conflict of 20 years, but more than ever, the world is watching what we do here today. Right now, there are malign actors who seek to attack us and do us harm, she said. This has been a reliable power move over the decades. When one threat fades away, another seems to come along at the right time. The so-called War on Terror is a spent force, but now there is China, as they claim, which devotes two-thirds less to its defense than the U.S. and is not known to be planning any 9/11-style attack on the homeland, but is having a conveniently timed Sputnik moment. In the end, the committee voted 42-17 to increase the budget, with 14 Democrats joining 28 Republicans. The committee spent far more time debating critical race theory, but about 2 hours than the amendment to cut the budget about 30 minutes. It's as if we have learned nothing from the past 20 years, said Representative Sarah Jacobs, a Democrat from California, during the debate. She noted that rather than pumping money into the military, more resources could go toward diplomacy, education, infrastructure, and public health. That is what will determine if we are competitive with China, not whether we have more F-35 that even the Pentagon says they don't need, she concluded. The fundamental idea behind her argument was evoked during the Vietnam War by Martin Luther King Jr., who warned in 1967, a nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. If you want to understand the soul-killing trajectory of U.S. military spending, you should look at a recent home purchase in Beverly Hills, California. Last month, a wealthy buyer paid $20.9 million for a mansion with 8,600 square feet of living space that includes 5 bedrooms, 7 bathrooms, and an interior courtyard with an olive tree. The buyer's name, according to a news article that was widely shared on social media, is Daud Wardak. Little is known about Wardak except that his father was a defense minister in Afghanistan, and his older brother founded an obscure logistics company that landed more than $250 million in U.S. military contracts. It's not clear how Wardak was able to purchase his new residence or the $5.2 million condo he also owns in Miami Beach, Florida. But what's known is that nearly half of U.S. military expenditures since 9/11, total is about $14 trillion, have gone to contractors. Some are global brands of lethality, such as Raytheon and General Dynamics, while others are pop-up entities with headquarters that are post office boxes. The money that has vanished through corruption is legendary as well as unknowable. Because the Pentagon has never passed an audit, and until recently it didn't even try to conduct one. The scenario of national deformation that was predicted in 1961 by President Dwight Eisenhower, who warned in his farewell address of the rise of a military-industrial complex. The numbers behind this deformation are stunning. Since 2001, the 5 largest weapons manufacturers in the U.S. have spent more than $1.1 billion lobbying the government. And the statistics doesn't even include their donations to candidates, the funding of think tanks, or their payments to generals who become board members. These investments have paid off, according to Stephen Semler of the Security Policy Reform Institute, which calculates that those 5 firms have received more than $2 trillion in government contracts since 2001.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
September 2nd, 2021. On the occasion of the National Government Week, President Raisi and the cabinet members met with Imam Khamenei in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya during the first days after the formation of the 30th administration.
Well, there are other things to be said about economy as well. In my opinion, two points are important here. One is that in solving economic problems, we should not seek temporary solutions, painkillers, and the like. This is because such problems sometimes aggravate the issue. These painkillers and temporary cures sometimes worsen the situation. In order to overcome these challenges, we should think of fundamental solutions and begin to take firm steps by relying on God and by adopting good measures. The next point is that you should not make the resolution of these problems contingent upon the removal of sanctions. The removal of sanctions does not depend on us. It depends on others. Planning on the resolution of problems should be done by assuming that sanctions will be there. You should plan like this, so that one can move the task forward.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
These problems should and will be resolved with your own determination and with your own jihadi effort. On the issue of culture and media, I believe that the cultural structure of the country needs a revolutionary reconstruction. We have a problem in the cultural structure of the country, and a revolutionary move is necessary there. Of course, revolutionary move means a wise and rational move. Being revolutionary does not mean moving rashly and ill-advisedly. The move should be revolutionary and fundamental, but at the same time, it should originate from thinking and wisdom. Culture is really an infrastructure. Some of the mistakes that we commit in different areas stem from the wrong culture that dominates our minds. If we consume extravagantly, if we copy others blindly, if we lead a wrong lifestyle, these result from cultural problems and from the culture ruling over minds.
Allah Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rashal Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
There will be no trial, charges, or even a disciplinary hearing for two police officers involved in killing an 80-year-old woman inside her home with a tear gas grenade. It's the latest example of French cops hurting citizens and not facing even minor consequences. At the start of the Yellow Vest movement in 2018, police were clashing with protesters in the Mediterranean city of Marseille. Algerian national Zineb Redouane was in her fourth floor apartment trying to close her shutters when she was shot and killed. Redouane was on the phone with her daughter at the time of the incident, and she reportedly said, quote, "He targeted me. The police targeted me. I made eye contact with two policemen. One fired at me. Then they got in their car and left," end quote. She died the next day from her injuries.
Et aujourd'hui?
We have suffered repression, which no president has ever permitted in the history of this country. We are not at war. We are not enemies. But the government has waged war against us simply because we oppose their decisions. Just for that, many have paid dearly.
For months, the Interior Minister falsely claimed that the death had nothing to do with the grenade and that she died of cardiac arrest. Half of Redouane's face was collapsed in by the grenade. She inhaled large amounts of tear gas.
On a subi une répression.
The government has not given one word of apology or one moment of compassion towards any victims of police brutality during the Yellow Vest era. Also, there has not been one word of condemnation for the police who have committed these acts. None of the police have been convicted, even though people have been blinded, crippled, and lost. Of course, our heart goes out to the grieving family, and the Yellow Vest will continue to remember Zainab Redouane and to demand justice.
Her family has sued the Interior Minister and other senior officials for concealing and interfering with evidence. A ballistics investigation by the NGO Disclose suggested that police fired directly at Redouane's window.
Many wonder if there might have been some admission of wrongdoing if the victim wasn't Arab. That appears likely, but she also joins a Yellow Vest-related casualty list, which includes 5,000 people seriously hurt, 1,000 critically injured, scores maimed for life, and 11 other deaths. Amin Mazahari, Paris.
Meet Miqdad Kawasme, a Palestinian prisoner held in an Israeli jail without charge or trial under the regime's so-called administrative detention policy. He's among the six inmates who went on hunger strike in protest of their indefinite imprisonment weeks ago. Sunday marked the 109th day since he last ate. Israeli medics forcibly injected him with nutrients on the 92nd day of its strike. Other hunger strikers are Kayed Al-Fasfus, Ala Arraj, Hisham Abu Hawash, Ayad Hureini, and Luay Al-Ashqar. The hunger strikers, particularly Fasfus and Kawasme, are grappling with deteriorating health conditions, with Palestinian officials warning that the inmates are at immediate risk of death. On Sunday, over 4,500 Palestinians in different Israeli jails also rejected their meals in solidarity with the six hunger strikers. Palestinians in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip have held sit-ins and demonstrations over the past weeks demanding their immediate release. The United Nations Human Rights Commission has expressed grave concern over the lives of the prisoners. The UN body also criticized Israel's administrative detention practice, calling it a violation of international law. But no word or action is coming from Israel's powerful and influential Western allies. Experts believe the striking similarities they see with Israel to be the reason.
There is a tremendous imbalance of power in the world. And just as we see the tremendous crimes carried out by Western imperialist powers, the ongoing use of illegal sanctions, unilateral coercive measures to starve countries, invasions and occupations, the unstinting support Zionist occupation of Palestine is part and parcel of those crimes.
Palestinian inmates regularly stage hunger strikes in protest at their illegal detention and harsh conditions in Israeli jails. What they're fighting for are their most basic and fundamental rights.
Iran's nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, has been in the spotlight for quite some time now, after the U.S. in May 2018 unilaterally withdrew from it and reinstated sanctions on the Islamic Republic. In recent months, all eyes have been on Iran to see what approach it takes over the JCPOA after the country's new administration, led by President Ebrahim Raisi, came to power in August.
We support the negotiations that guarantee our national interests, but Iran will not tie its economy and the lives of its people to the negotiations, nor will it allow negotiations for the sake of negotiations. We will not let the negotiations become attritional.
When the administration of President Joe Biden took office in January, Iran and the remaining parties to the JCPOA held six rounds of talks in the Austrian capital before they were suspended in June due to Washington's failure to remove the sanctions. The U.S. and its Western allies exerted pressure on Iran over the past months to resume the talks, but Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian said Iran will first review the previous Vienna negotiations and then start talks with Russia, China, the UK, France, and Germany, known as the P4 plus 1 group. Just last week, Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Bagheri Kani said Iran and the EU agreed that Tehran and the P4 plus 1 start talks on November 29th. He stressed that the talks should result in the removal of sanctions on Iran. The terminology that the Iranian official has used for the upcoming talks attaches significance to Tehran's approach towards the JCPOA. The term start conveys the message that Iran seeks to begin result-oriented negotiations. Talks with the aim of removing sanctions indicates that the revival of the JCPOA and the U.S. return to the deal is not of substantial importance to Iran. What matters is the removal of all sanctions under various titles in action and not on paper. The U.S. has been trying to push Iran to succumb to its demands via the so-called maximum pressure campaign that was launched by the Trump administration following its unilateral JCPOA pullout. But such a pressure campaign has backfired, since Iran has strengthened its defense capabilities, advanced its nuclear program, and begun to enrich uranium to the 60% level. Now, the ball is in the court of the U.S. and its Western allies. They should decide before November 29th on whether they want to take a lesson from the so-called maximum pressure campaign, which top White House officials have explicitly branded as a failed policy, or go on with their anti-Iran agenda. The new Iranian government believes that national interests will be achieved by increasing the country's power. What is certain for now is that the speed of Iran's enrichment shows that the country will not accept restrictions on its nuclear activities in case of non-compliance by the United States.